Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. And it's show number 12. This time we're back with anarchy in the Lower Haight, which I guess is not that unusual, actually. But we do have our interview with Ben Blue from the magazine Anarchy. If you enjoyed the first part of the interview, then we delve even deeper into the shallow waters, or we dive more shallowly into the deep waters of anarchy in this show. And I do want to take a moment out today to remind people that we're on the Mondo Globo Network, www.mondoglobo.net, and that we got a very cool new show on Mondo Globo, which is a San Francisco events show hosted by our very own producer, Jeff Deal. His mom is very proud of him. His mom from Florida, she is just so proud because she didn't think he was going to amount to shit. But here he is. He's doing a show on the Mondo Globo Network, MGN. And Jeff, why don't you tell people about your show?
Well, it's pretty simple, and it's, of course, San Francisco-centric, so the audience is somewhat limited, but those who are in the area or visiting the area have a pretty good resource for finding out what's going on in San Francisco as far as arts, music, film, whatever, mostly underground stuff. We're connected to laughingsquid.com, which is the main resource for most people to find out about these events, and you know, we're linked to prominently from their homepage.
But, you know, I want to say, actually, that even if you aren't planning to go out to events in San Francisco, there's always cool interviews with artists and the people who put on events, and they're interesting.
Yeah, in fact, not all of it is time-based to events. Some of it is just, you know, interviews with interesting figures.
So, in fact, anybody can listen. But in the meantime, here we are with Are You Serious show number 12, and you'll be pleased to know that Diana Brown is back. And hi, Diana.
Hi, Are You? Thanks for having me back. Hey, Jeff, how's it going?
Hey, Diana.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
Well, I was reading an article in the Washington Post the other day. Staff writer Rick Weiss, say that three times fast, Rick Weiss. But he brought to my attention that the internet is currently being likened to the great libraries of Alexandria and their destruction. And he goes on to say that the average lifespan of a web page is about 100 days, and many documents now only exist as a web page. They're not even physical documents. They exist only online, such as the British government's dossier on Iraqi weapons. So what the question is being posed is, will history be there when historians look for us? Will we have evaporated? And things are being done. Obviously, digital archivists are trying to take snapshots of the web. But there's also research and programs being created, new indexing and retrieval systems. And one such system is known as DOI, or Digital Object Identifier. And you can actually check them out on their website at www.doi.org. But the point being that all this incredible data is being generated, and then 100 days later, we can't find it.
Well, history is in for a lot of trouble, I think, in the future, between the stuff that disappears and the stuff that overwhelms and
exactly.
The amount of sludge and disinformation.
Apparently.
So, but I always thought that everything that goes up on the internet is you can find it if you want to. I mean, that's always been, you know, people say, you know, watch what you say, because somewhere you know,
well, nothing is preserved.
But every time a computer gets disconnected from the internet, that whatever was on that computer is gone unless somebody else copied it and put it on there.
Exactly. And we, you know, we may look for something at one URL, but then it's not there. So that's the hope of the DOI system, is that even if you have a wandering web page, it will be able to identify and mark with kind of a code, so that no matter where that information migrates to through the DOI, you can actually find it, sort of like an internet shepherd.
What's odd is that official government groups aren't necessarily creating physical documents.
And exactly.
The case that they used there of the British government's thing on Iraqi weapons, that could be pretty intentional.
This,
you know,
true.
They would like that to disappear.
Oops.
Because it was like
not
all,
so many.
All bullshit.
Yeah, I've often wondered a little bit about that, like top secret documents, you know,
right.
Like the thing that showed the plot against the plot to send down the airliner over Cuba to make it look like Fidel Castro had
exactly.
shot it down to justify
right.
war on Cuba. Is the Bush administration recording stuff like this? You know, I mean, I have a feeling that it's different now, that back then, even though it was secret from the public at the time, they were recording it, and when they would release it later. I just have a feeling there's so much stuff being done completely off the grid now that nobody will ever know the kind of shit that's being done covertly.
It's pretty simple and obvious to decide that you have a, you know, to come up with a way to conceal information, you know, forever. And I mean, even if some individuals come out later and say this, thus and such happened, there's always plausible denial. I always wondered also about documents, is, you know, could the documents themselves be fraudulent? I mean, there was all this information that came out of the Soviet Union from the KGB, many of which played into some of the right wing's claims about Alger Hiss and so forth. Did somebody pay the KGB to do this? I have no reason to believe this, so, but you never know. Happy to have Ben Blue with us once again. Actually, only a few minutes has passed by, but it could be as much as a month or so since you last listened to him on the RU Series show. If you did indeed listen to him, or if you're just catching up, you may want to go back and listen to the first interview with Ben Blue and catch up to this point, because he explained everything you needed to know about anarchism in our first interview. It was all completely clarified in that initial discussion. And there's really not much more to do except kick back and talk about how great the Sex Pistols were. But really, I mean, anarchism. And the first question on anybody's mind is can human beings truly exist, particularly in a mass society, in a non-hierarchical society with no state? I mean, most people go, anarchy, you got to be kidding. So what do you think about, Chomsky says there's no such thing as human nature.
Well,
I think there probably is such a thing as human nature, and that it's very large and malleable, but it needs to be explored before you can say that such a system is plausible. Go ahead.
Okay.
This isn't about me talking.
Right. No. Yeah, and the best response that I've heard to the question of human nature is from a fellow who's been with the magazine for probably 10 years now and is now one of the primary forces in producing it here in the Bay Area, Lawrence Jirok. And he feels that the question of human nature is irrelevant to this discussion, that some people will take a Hobbesian approach and say that human nature is inherently evil or greedy, or however you want to phrase it, that we're by nature antisocial. Others will take a Rousseauian perspective, that if it weren't for all of the horrible, degrading institutions that we've created over the last few thousand years, humans are angels. And we just need to chuck all of that, and then everything's going to be fine. And the counter argument that Lawrence proposes is that, well, if humans are inherently good, then we don't need the institution of the state. And if humans are inherently evil, then we certainly want to avoid the greediest, most power-seeking, most evil people being placed in a position of authority over us. And for me, I think that what anarchy does, the discourse, not necessarily the magazine, but I would hope that the magazine as well, it opens up a space for dialogue with an experimental approach, saying that the future is not determined. It is open to whatever experiments we care to make with one another as individuals and in groups. And it remains an open question of whether or not an anarchist society is possible. And some people would define an anarchist as someone who regards a society without rulers or hierarchy as both desirable and possible. And I find an anarchist society, as I envision it, highly desirable. I remain agnostic about the question of whether or not it's possible. And I think that a negative definition, a definition of a statist, would be someone who believes that an anarchist society is neither desirable nor possible. One of the books that I found interesting.
Well, no, I mean, a statist might believe that it's desirable but not possible, and therefore you try to create the least authoritarian society in which people can continue to live and, you know.
Right, so you'd have minarchists.
Because if you dissolve into a state of anarchy, human beings, by their nature, will likely create some form of hierarchy over again. Anyway, perhaps in a form that is worse than say post Enlightenment society might offer.
I have a question.
Ask him though, not me.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm just letting you know.
Yeah. Because I'm bloviating.
What do you think is the single biggest perpetrator institution in existence right now? And then does it make sense to even think in those terms of single targets, like let's target the most aggressive or egregious institution and somehow invalidate it or dismantle it or discredit it or whatever? Does that make any sense, or is it more a sense of like just trying to present a complete picture to a certain class of people who will then
I don't think that a complete picture ever can be presented. I think that we're at a point where many people can recognize that there is no path towards omniscience, that we live in societies that are too complex for anybody to know everything that's going on. I think that one of the strategies that Noam Chomsky uses a lot of times is an immanent critique, where he takes the sound bites put forth by the heads of state and accepts them at their word as though they were honest and reliable, and then goes about demolishing their arguments and showing them, no, they're a bunch of liars and murderers and worse, and hopes that, enough people will recognize the validity of his critique and then they'll do something to deal with the situation. And I don't know how useful an imminent critique is. I think it's maybe better at this point to just begin with the proposition that all governments lie, that we go back to some of the, well, not founders necessarily, but maybe second wave anarchists like Emma Goldman, who would say that her definition of anarchism is the theory that all government is based upon violence and is therefore wrong and unnecessary. And you'll even find the Supreme Court concurring. I forgot which decision it was, but then he said, well, in the final analysis, the state is an agency of violence. That it's specifically, it's a monopoly on socially sanctioned violence within a given society in which specific people have assigned roles. I think from looking at this from a psychological perspective, if we look at things like the experiments of Stanley Milgram on obedience to authority or the Stanford Prison Experiment, once you set up a social situation in which you have roles of...
Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, Abu Ghraib is a very good contemporary example of this, that when you set up those social roles, you can expect these kind of behaviors to occur. And until we deal with looking at these institutions and doing whatever we can to dismantle them, we're not going to enter into the age where warfare and torture are relics of a bygone era.
You're speaking about anarchy as a political, social institution, excuse me. But what do you see as the relationship between anarchy and biology and species? There aren't many species that have no organization within themselves.
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and I think this is one of the directions I would like to go in future issues of the magazine, is move beyond the post-left anarchism to a post-humanist anarchism. I'd really like to examine, say, the works of Howard Bloom that assert that we're naturally, genetically set up, hardwired, if you will, to establish hierarchical forms of social organization. Look at the work of John Gray with straw dogs on humans and other animals, and really examine these questions. And I think that I'm the perpetual multiple model agnostic, that I'll look at this data and I don't know if I'm going to draw the same conclusion. I think that if you look at something like the work of James DeMayo in Saharasia, you could just as easily say that, well, maybe authoritarian behavior derives from nurture rather than nature, that the rapid aridification of the Semitic fertile crescent approximately 4,000 BC might have given rise to authoritarian hierarchical states that imposed their authoritarian values upon the what he calls the more matrist cultures around them.
Then how about other species like lions?
That if you look at these, we find a lot of evidence of hierarchical social organization in a great many animal species.
Do you find, within the left, within a large part of the political left, there's a great... prejudice against even contemplating that biology might have something to do with human behavior and human organization? I mean, basically the only groups that deny that biology might have something to do with all of this are people on the left and religious fanatics. You find within the anarchist community there are also a lot of people who are very resistant to, obviously social Darwinism takes it to a certain extreme and makes a lot of big assumptions, way ahead of the curve of what we understand. But, are people within anarchist culture also reactive to this?
I think many people are reluctant to even look at it because, of course, you have the legacy of 20th century totalitarianisms like Hitler's that have gone to great lengths with their own variety of pseudoscience, with master races and slave races. And my hunch is that that there may very well be some biological determinants that can at least act as contributing factors towards the creation of hierarchical societies. I think one example where that would be a good one for people to look at is if you look at the work of Rhianne Eisler with she's fascinated with the bonobos, species of chimpanzees very closely related to humans, which have much less violence than most other primate species. And I'm very interested.
And a lot more sex.
And a lot more sex. Much more sex positive, very Reichian primates. And, and you know, if chimpanzees can figure out how to create a generally happy society, well, maybe humans are clever enough to follow the lead of some of the chimps. And I'm also very interested in ongoing developments in neuroscience, in conversations with Howard Bloom, where, you know, he has identified himself to me as, you know, the foremost opponent of anarchism and socialism. And where we've agreed to find some meeting ground is I put forward the proposition to him that there could be a great deal of liberatory potential within the plasticity of the neocortex, that we have the ability to learn new behaviors and discard old behaviors. And I have other neuroscientist friends who feel it's not just the neocortex, that the entire brain exhibits a great deal of neuroplasticity. So maybe a lot of the rules that we've inherited take a Sheldrakean approach.
So yeah, I mean, what I imagine is that you might have a state where no authority is required once people's brains are completely controlled. I think that's, you know, that's probably, you know, once people are more or less incapable of violence. But I mean, although I don't think people will choose when people are trying to do. Choose traits for children when they're able to do that. I think people will probably choose aggression, as well as intelligence and strength and so forth. So I doubt if we're headed towards that. But I'm rambling, as usual. Maybe we should take a moment's break for some music and come back for a few minutes.
Are you serious? Thank you. Are you serious?
We're back with Ben Blue from Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed. And so if people are getting a good vibe, a great hit off of anarchism and anarchy, and they want to get involved, what would you recommend? How would you recommend, you know, particularly if they're not in the Bay Area?
How do you get started?
How do you get, yeah, what's the kit? How does one get started as
report to your local anarchy recruiting center.
Okay, good. We'll be setting one of those up.
Is there a slogan we should know?
No slogans. There have been plenty of slogans.
Does everybody who calls himself an anarchist have to learn Bakunin and Kropotkin? I remember somebody telling me that back in the 70s. I could never fight my way through their essays, actually, I must admit.
Yeah, I think that some people might really get off on doing that. You know, I'm certainly a great reader, and I enjoy returning to the classics. But I don't think that's necessary. I think one good way to hop into all of this is to find some like-minded friends and start a study group, a reading group where pick something, anything, whether it's Anarchy Magazine or Green Anarchy or any kind of anarchist publication you can find out there. You've got a World Wide Web you can look at. Find something that appeals to you and begin talking with your friends about the ideas that you find in it. And then if you're so moved, move beyond the realm of theory into the realm of action. Find some sort of anarchist project that you're interested in. I think the basic organizing principles of an anarchist ethic come down to voluntary association, mutual aid, and direct action. That you want to avoid involuntary association, say with police or prison guards, various heads of state. Spend time associating with those that you really want to associate with. Mutual aid, help people out. Direct action, don't wait for permission from somebody in order to do what you feel needs to be done. Those to me would be the basics of any sort of anarchist organizing, and you can spin off variations from that, whether you're going to be developing your anarchist communist union or your green anarchy cadre, or cadre is a bad word to use in this context, but That would be my suggestion to people.
All right, so one last question, Ben Blue. If you could be any kind of twee, what kind of twee would you want to be?
Well, I would want to be an oak tree. I have a column in the next issue of Anarchy. We're forming a local chapter, the Oakland chapter of the Autonomous Astronauts Association, and I have a vision we're not going to plant any flags. We'll tear down the American flag, but we're not going to put up a black flag in its place. We're going to establish a oak forest on the moon. And so we're taking, it's obviously not a primitivist position. We're going to need some flying saucers to get there. But we're going to start exploring in this column anarchist tactics towards getting off of this planet, going somewhere new. And so I want an oak tree on the moon, and that's my vision.
It's a spaceship.
Space migration. I hear the ancient whisper of an old friend. All right. Thank you, Ben Blue, for coming in.
Are you serious?
Hey, this is some employed mainstream radio guy, and I got something to tell you. We'd like to thank Ben Blue for joining us once again on the Are You Serious show. Our gang of four today was Are You Serious, Diana Brown, Sherry Miller, and Jeff Deal. Next week, Tim Cavanaugh from Reason Magazine and Ken Jenkins from 911truth.org join us for a discussion about 9/11 conspiracy theory. The Are You Serious show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Go to MondoGlobo.net and check out all of our fine shows, including Neophiles, The Master Chat Show, and The Brand Spankin' New Junket 415. Subscribe to the entire network feed at MondoGlobo.net. This has been the Are You Serious Show? Don't be afraid of the dark.